Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, arguably the four most important states in deciding who you get to choose between for president every 4 years. But why? And is that a good idea? After all, none of this is written in stone, or the Constitution for that matter. States and parties could chart different paths if they wanted to. And in a piece out today, my colleague Jeffrey Skelly reimagined what the primary calendar might look like if it were to prioritize states that reflect who Democratic voters actually are. And he's here with me to talk about some of the effects of the current system and how things might be different. Jeffrey, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also here with us today is Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
I don't get a welcome. I just get a hey.
You know, you're always here. You know that you're welcome whenever you want.
Okay, thank you.
Mi casa es tu casa. But let's begin with Jeffrey. How out of step is the makeup of the current primary calendar with the Democratic Party's makeup?
It's pretty far off. The way I looked at it is I created a potential Democratic electorate. And so overall in the U.S., it's about 40%. Of the Democrats are whites without a college degree. A quarter are whites with a college degree. About 20% are African Americans, 9% Hispanic, and then everybody else. And then I looked at each state's Democratic electorate and basically lined up the ones that were closest to the national Democratic electorate. If you go sort of state by state, New Hampshire and Iowa dropped toward the bottom half of the pack, as does South Carolina. And really only Nevada stays up toward the top.
So if the primary calendar were to reflect the states that are most similar to the Democratic electorate, what would be the order, at least the top four?
Yeah, the first four, based on what I found, would be Illinois leading everything off, New Jersey, New York, and then Florida, and then Nevada in fifth.
Nate, how do you think the primary would be different if the order went Illinois, New Jersey, New York, and then Florida?
I mean, you would have candidates who better represent the majority of voters in the party.
Is there a very clear argument for prioritizing states that demographically match your voters? Is there any argument against it?
Well, people would say that, like, you want states where there is small retail campaigning because they reward skills that are desirable in a nominee, and because these states can serve as kind of laboratories of democracy. But I mean, here's the thing. First of all, it's BS to talk about the first four together. It's BS because Iowa and New Hampshire, the way the press treats them, and we're part of the press, so we're part of the problem, receive probably five times as much media coverage as South Carolina and Nevada. And they're both super, super white states, which maybe for Republicans is less of a problem because most of their voters are white. But for Democrats, I guess most Democrats, 60% are white, but 40% of the Democratic electorate is not white. And so it seems like a big problem to have two of the whitest states in the country that are so important in dictating nominations. They also don't have very good food.
Which is important for, of course, reporters who are traveling,
which is important.
Parachuting in.
Yeah. You know, I mean, if you're not going to go by demographic equality, then pick some states that have better food.
Fair enough. Okay, so Jeffrey, how do you think that the Democratic primary might be different if, say, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Florida were first, or at least Illinois and New Jersey were the first two?
Well, obviously, running in New Hampshire and Iowa is different from running in, say, Illinois and New Jersey at the start. I mean, those are much larger states in terms of population. They have very expensive media markets, Chicago, New York, and Philadelphia for New Jersey as well. So maybe that would put more of an emphasis on fundraising early on. That obviously runs sort of counter to the idea of having these small states kick off the process where maybe retail politics is more important. You know, it's harder to shake a lot of hands in Illinois, at least as a share of the population, than Iowa. I mean, there's almost 13 million people in Illinois, and there are about 3 million in Iowa. So that would be a different challenge and might make money even more important in the process. And it's already, obviously, something to keep an eye on.
It's interesting that when you order the states according to how similar they are to the Democratic electorate, South Carolina comes in towards the bottom, even though we consider that as one of the states that first gives us an example of how the candidates can appeal to a broader, more diverse coalition. Is that just a test of how well they can appeal to black voters? And apart from that, the Democratic electorate isn't that diverse in South Carolina?
It's that if you have, what is it, in Jeffrey's data, 58% black, that's also not representative of an electorate that's 20% black across the country. So it's kind of like trying to make up for Iowa. I mean, look, there is no reason why Iowa and New Hampshire should get to go first every year. Maybe if you really have four states that balance one another out, then you can go to some smaller states and, you know, you don't have to every state be spot on with the averages. But, like, I don't know. It's four really weird states to pick. And there are also states where, like, the demographics are more similar and are somewhat smaller. So Indiana, for example, actually has a real city. No offense to Des Moines. I like Des Moines. It's a nice place. But Indianapolis is a real city with a considerably more diverse population than you have anywhere in Iowa, for example. You know, Delaware actually shows up in Jeffrey's top 10. That's a small little state, and it's got more diversity than New Hampshire does. Where are Iowa and New Hampshire?
They're real low.
Iowa's 42nd and New Hampshire's 34th. So you're really going toward the bottom of the list in terms of having demographically representative states.
Of course, part of the goal of a primary is to nominate a candidate that will go on to win a general election. So does it make more sense to have the primary states that go first match the Democratic electorate or the general electorate overall?
Again, you have some options here. Florida is fourth. Nevada is fifth. Pennsylvania is sixth. Arizona is 17th. Michigan's 11th. Ohio is 13th. Virginia's 14th. So there are states that, and oftentimes you would expect states with demographics that are pretty typical of the country to be swingier potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if you want a mix of like small states and swing states, you can still find better versions of them than Iowa and New Hampshire.
Okay. So we've been talking about the Democratic electorate. Jeffrey, do you have data about the Republican electorate and which states would best align with Republican voters?
Yeah. So I took a quick look because I really had focused on the Democratic side, but I looked at two options. You could either sort of divide the Republicans up by ideology. So like very conservative, and then basically everybody else to the left of that. And then also you could try dividing them by, are they born again evangelical Christians or not? And so I looked at both of those, and actually on the ideology score, Illinois ended up being closest, interestingly. So if you wanted to use that, you could actually have Illinois leading off on both sides.
So basically, Illinois, you are America.
Yes, Illinois is America. And then on the evangelical front, actually Wyoming ended up being closest in terms of the percentage that were evangelicals and the percentage that were not. So that's a big state with not a lot of people.
So for the sake of understanding the Republican electorate as well, how does the Republican electorate break down along those ideological or religious lines?
Right. So a little over 40% in the CCES data said that they were born-again Christians who were Republicans or Trump voters, and then just shy of 60% were not. So that's sort of what you're looking to match up with. And then on the ideology front, it was like 55% were conservative, and then very conservative was just like 15-20%. And then everybody else was the remainder. So that was sort of how it matched up. Though there was a small percentage of people, like 2-3%, who said they were liberal or very liberal, who voted for Trump or identified as Republican.
And those are the people who are just trolling pollsters.
No. They might have disliked Hillary.
The Susan Sarandons of the world. All right, I want to get into a little bit more of why the calendar is set up the way it is right now and other ways that the parties could set up the primary calendar or change the primary in general. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect with qualified candidates. And that place is ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address. ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/, and then the numbers, 538. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, we're back. We should explain a little bit why the calendar is the way it is. Nate, you said that there's no reason that Iowa and New Hampshire have to go first every 4 years. So why do they?
Because they're really whiny. and complainy, and they get very offended if it feels like someone might move in front of them. And, like, sometimes whiny states get their way.
Uh-huh. And why don't the parties just come in and say, you know what, we're going to Bigfoot this. You're small states. You're not representative of our voters. Sorry.
They should.
They should. All right.
They don't have any guts.
They don't have any guts. Well, we often say on this podcast that the parties are small C conservative. So maybe they're just comfortable with the way things have always been.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to sort of look at it as something of an accident of history. And then because you have a lot of different actors determining when states vote, you know, the parties only have so much say. State legislatures will pass statutes or give power to, like, the Secretary of State to set the date at a certain point. So, like, New Hampshire, I mean, it's held a presidential primary since 1916. It's gone first since 1920. That's a little confusing, though, I think, to people, because they might imagine, oh, they were voting on presidential candidates in 1920. But they really didn't start doing that, like, by name, you know, voting for X candidate until 1952. Before that, it was just delegates. And so, really, you have to look at the modern primary system as really dating only back to the 1970s. And so New Hampshire was going first when we really started to decide a lot of delegates by primaries. And so they've clung on to their first in the nation primary status ever since then. And they'll move up. The Secretary of State in New Hampshire has a ton of leeway to move the primary so that it will be first every time. And even when other states have moved up to challenge New Hampshire's position over the years, New Hampshire has always moved further forward in the calendar. And similarly, Iowa actually is a super accident of history, because in 1972, the state party decided to hold their precinct caucuses in January because of when the Democrats scheduled their national convention. And they went first that year, but people weren't really paying that close of attention. But in 1976, they were still going first, and Jimmy Carter basically made Iowa his campaign headquarters, and got a lot of, ended up getting some national media attention there, and it sort of broadened his national appeal, and then he ended up winning the caucuses. So that really turned Iowa into this huge media event that gets all this attention. And so, considering it's a caucus and not like a state-run primary like New Hampshire, in that case, the state parties have cooperated to always keep Iowa first, even before New Hampshire, actually, in the calendar.
Nate, you talked a little bit at the very beginning about the effects that the current system has by saying that candidates, therefore, are being judged first and foremost by very white, very small states. Can we point to specific examples of how the current primary calendar has shaped who ends up winning the nomination or how these campaigns are waged?
You've had, look, a lot of Democratic nominees from the Northeast have probably been helped maybe by having New Hampshire go pretty early, and from the Midwest are probably helped by Iowa. And it, believe me, it can sometimes be diverse candidates. I mean, Obama, I think, got like a Midwestern benefit, but Obama obviously did have a lot of appeal to African-American voters. You haven't had a lot of candidates from the West achieve success in the Democratic primaries because those states tend to be backloaded and less relevant. You know, not all that many nominations have been that close necessarily, so it's kind of hard to point to one and say, okay, this candidate won because of TKTK states or TKTK order. TKTK is like journalists speak for to come, by the way.
Yes.
And by the way, there have been a lot of misses, too, where Iowa and New Hampshire in both parties do not predict who eventually wins the nomination. In particular, for Republicans in Iowa, it's pretty rare for Iowa to pick the right winner. We've had Santorum win and Huckabee win and Ted Cruz win in the last three Republican primaries in Iowa. And those candidates don't go on to win their nominations, obviously, or really even be all that much of a threat to do so in the case of Huckabee, for example.
I mean, the way it's set up right now, the two states that lead off do the most winnowing because at the end of the day, they're the first votes that we get to react to. And so I think the fact that Iowa and New Hampshire start that process and are pretty unrepresentative of the Democratic Party is kind of fundamentally problematic. I mean, people are going to respond the most to how candidates perform there just because that's the first vote or in those two states. And they're usually about 8 days apart. Iowa's caucuses are usually on a Monday, not a Tuesday, weirdly enough. So that's sort of my take on it and why those states are so important and why there's sort of a problem with them going first.
And with the winnowing thing, I mean, I think the fact that Iowa and New Hampshire are both kind of idiosyncratic, I think that actually makes them less effective at winnowing, because you can have a candidate who appeals to Iowa because they're Midwestern, because in the GOP they're an evangelical conservative and a party that in some ways has moved toward people. Let's call them Donald Trump, right, who are maybe not the most traditional evangelical candidates. And so it's like, okay, you win Iowa, and now you have a ticket to compete in this whole next set of primaries, even though maybe you aren't really viable nationally, a Rick Santorum or something, right? I mean, look, I should say, and Jeff hinted at this, one of the arguments for having these smaller states go first is because it allows a candidate with fewer resources to compete there and not just kind of win an air war with advertisements and whatever else, right? But, like, we have had several kind of long and drawn-out nomination processes recently for Democrats in 2008 and in 2016 and for Republicans in 2016. And, frankly, I think we're going to have probably, we don't know, good chance of another drawn-out nomination process in 2020. So, I don't know. I think this current setup is not being that helpful for winnowing, where if you can't, for example, win in an Illinois or a Florida or a New Jersey or New York, states that are representative of the party as a whole, that would probably be a more meaningful indication, right? If Kamala Harris can't win in Iowa, well, it's a bunch of rural white people, you know, that's not the most important constituency in the party. If she can't win in New York, that's a big problem for the type of coalition that she would be trying to build.
Okay, well, I am going to give you guys a challenge. Nate, Jeffrey, if it were up to you and you were deciding the order of, we'll focus on the Democratic primary since that seems to be the important one this cycle, how would you order the first four states? If you, Nate Silver, you, Jeffrey Skelly, got to pick.
I mean, maybe we do like an NBA style lottery.
Okay, give me your logic.
That all states should have an opportunity sometimes to vote early. Again, I don't think it's necessarily a bad, I don't know. Maybe you design an algorithm where the first four states need to be collectively balanced demographically. I don't know, right? Maybe they all vote on the same day and they rotate or something like that, right? You put states into groups and they rotate every year into like 12 groups of four states. I guess we're missing some states now.
We can leave.
Call it, because you also have the territories in Washington, D.C. So why don't you create four groups of 13 states and you rotate them? I mean, look, I just think like, literally, the way it's done now is literally worse than random because you're giving these states that are not representative disproportionate amounts of influence, right? So for me, the alternatives are have a similar system like now where the same states go early every year, but they are more representative, or just randomize stuff or rotate stuff so that every year the order is a bit different.
Can I eke an answer out of you? If you were going to do the four first set states, which would they be? Don't worry, this won't be enacted. We're just spitballing here.
I would go for, so let's say you're going for some medium-sized states, right? I think New Jersey.
New Jersey, okay.
Let's give New Jersey, right? I kind of like New Jersey. There's like Atlantic City. There's like, the food's actually pretty decent in New Jersey.
That's a controversial thing to say.
No, I mean, actually, it's a pretty diverse state. That's the whole point, right?
Right. Okay, so New Jersey?
Nevada's fine for me.
Nevada.
We need a Midwestern state here. I mean, Indiana.
Indiana.
We need a southern state, right? I mean, the southern ones tend to be a little bit less representative.
Georgia, maybe?
Georgia's pretty good. Although Georgia's pretty far down the line. I mean, the problem in the southern states for all of them is that in the southern states, most of the white people vote Republican. And so therefore, even though they can look pretty representative in the overall electorate, the Democratic electorate might not be as representative. Tennessee's on here. That could be interesting.
Okay, so
let's give it to Tennessee.
We've got New Jersey, Nevada, Indiana, and Tennessee as the first four states if Nate Silver got to decide the Democratic primary lineup. Congratulations, you four. Jeffrey, weigh in here. What are your first four states if you got to decide?
Yeah, you know, I agree with most of those picks. I mean, let me just go with I'm going to prioritize like the small state aspect. Let's just say that that's how I'll do it because that the retail politics thing is something that a lot of people still argue for. So if that's the case, maybe the western state is Nevada.
Okay.
The like eastern, northeastern state is Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Connecticut? Oh, come
maybe,
on, man.
I'm just, you know, on. If I'm trying to get that geographic balance, you know. And let's say the southern state, I mean, Arkansas is pretty small. I don't know. It's a thought. They'll have really good barbecue if that's really playing into your decision making.
Wait, Arkansas has good barbecue? I didn't know it was known for barbecue.
I mean, I don't know. It's in the South, so and I'm from the South, so I probably should know better. But I've never actually been to Arkansas.
Can we add Louisiana just for the food aspect?
Yes,
I like that. Okay, and then lastly, Midwest, Indiana. Yeah, Indiana is a good choice. So go with Indiana for Midwest.
To review that, Jeffrey, we have from you Nevada, Connecticut, Arkansas, and Indiana.
Sure. that would be an interesting mix.
Galen, what are your four?
My four, okay. I would make the argument that it's in the party's best interest to go with states that are representative of the electorate that is going to decide the general election. So in the Northeast, I would go Northeast kind of slash Midwest. I would go Pennsylvania. In the South, I would go Georgia.
So, you know, these are pretty big states now.
These are pretty big.
The small state thing.
You got to raise some money. But the thing is, modern campaigns do depend a lot on money, and you can still raise money through small dollar contributions.
I mean, Georgia is 45th, so you're showing open contempt for Jeffrey's methodology here. openly contemptuous.
Pennsylvania is 6th, and you chose Louisiana, which is 43rd.
I said if you're going to, I mean, I'm just saying, like, if you're going to go Arkansas, I'd put Louisiana first just for food.
Okay, so let me finish up. We have Pennsylvania, Georgia. I'm going to go with Minnesota and Arizona.
Minnesota 30th.
What about Arizona?
17th. So I think you actually, like, literally on average, your states are
in the middle.
In the middle.
That's fair. Pennsylvania, Georgia, Minnesota, Arizona. How do you guys feel about that?
I mean, why not do Wisconsin instead of Minnesota?
Minnesota's more diverse.
Minnesota's more diverse.
Yeah. Minnesota's more diverse and it's more urban, which better fits in some ways.
I mean, Wisconsin's higher in our metric here.
Galen didn't want to get the home state, like, bias thing put on his head, so.
Yeah, I didn't want to just pick Wisconsin because of my Wisconsin allegiances. And that's some decent, is that some decent food? You have Georgian food, Pennsylvania food, we can forget that.
No, Philly has good sandwiches. Philly has it's Sandwich City, USA. Philadelphia Tourism Bureau, I'm happy to, like, consult for you and develop that slogan for a large fee.
Hey, maybe it's a new ad campaign for the podcast.
Sandwich what is City, it? The USA. City of Brotherly Love and Love for Sandwiches?
And love for sandwiches.
Yeah. One other thing with this all gets sort of, you know, talking about, like, the states the way they are. I mean, here's the thing. After the first four states, you have days like Super Tuesday when, like, 10 states go at the same time, right? So I talk about this in the piece, but maybe another way of doing this would be to not worry so much about the individual state, but collectively each primary date be relatively representative if you sort of pooled all the voters together. So that would be sort of another way of getting at this and trying to make things more representative would be to sort of consider all the states voting on the same day and how they collectively match up.
So in that vein, why not just have all the states vote on the same day to begin with? Have one national primary day?
Because it's less fun. No, look, I think there is actually an argument that it is less fun. But it is an endurance test, the nomination campaign. And, you know, one thing a party wants to do is actually make it difficult to win the nomination, where you cannot just kind of peak as a flash in the pan at one time. I mean, frankly, there's an argument that you should have the general election also would take place on different days, right? Clinton wins a bunch of swing states and the Comey letter hits, right? Then Trump wins a bunch, right? And that fades out. And then who knows what happens? But, like, that could be kind of fun too. But I do think the notion that, like, it is an endurance test to win the nomination process. And, like, so I guess one argument against what we're doing is to say, okay, you want to be able to win under different circumstances in different types of contests because that tests the whole variety of your political skills and the breadth of your coalition. Like, maybe that's not a bad argument necessarily. It's just the fact that, again, of the first four, you know, we're in the media. We know that Iowa and New Hampshire get disproportionate amounts of influence relative to Nevada and South Carolina. So it's not four co-equal. It's two big ones and two kind of and those two are both the same ones every year, and they're both very white.
This is true. And before we go, from what I understand, the 2020 Democratic primary calendar is not set in stone at this point. States still have to vote. The party is still making some decisions. Jeffrey, what is the latest in terms of how this year will be different from years past?
Right. So I think the one that's gotten a lot of attention, and very understandably, is California. So California, in most years, has voted in June, but they've moved that up to March this year because they decided they wanted to be a part of Super Tuesday and really play a more influential role on the process. Now, they did that in 2008, and nonetheless, they, you know, how much of an influence they played is, I think, difficult to say compared to other Super Tuesday states necessarily. But anyway, they have moved up, and because of early voting in California, there actually will be votes taking place, like, before New Hampshire votes, at least potentially, if people actually fill out their ballots. So So I think that is an interesting aspect to how the calendar's changed. And I think just generally there are a number of states that on the Democratic side are not planning to use caucuses after using them in the past or switching over to primaries. So Minnesota, for instance, is going to be using a primary for the first time, I think, since 1992. Colorado is going to be using a primary from the looks of things. So there are some interesting changes there, and I think we might end up with a record number of states using a primary rather than a caucus to determine their delegates this time around.
Also, it seems like somewhere in the range of 75% of the delegates could be awarded by the end of March. What kind of impact does that have on how the primary plays out, Nate?
It has an impact where it might be harder to have a majority of delegates with any one candidate.
Because which
it
could is mean
brokered convention,
which is although what there are a lot we of, all live for in the political media.
Although there are a lot of in betweens where you know Kamala Harris has 43% and Beto O'Rourke is next close with 19, right? And then in that case, she would presumably win.
Super delegates might put her over the edge.
Well, they don't get to vote until the second ballot, but there are still these super delegates who would vote on the second ballot, and that'd be the easiest way to resolve it. Although, if things are really, 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 really divided, where you have like 17 candidates, I mean, how many do we have now? Like 14?
Yeah.
Are we counting Andrew Yang and what's her name, Williamson?
Marianne Williamson.
Marianne, I'm so sorry to the many people, many devotees of Marianne Williamson that I wasn't even sure what her first name was. But look, you also have a rule where you have to get 15% of the vote in the state or the congressional district to get any delegates at all. So things are really, really divided. Let's say in California, Kamala Harris' home state gets 33%. The next closest is Joe Biden with 14%. Then she gets all the delegates. So that's an interesting little twist. Although, it's done by congressional district. I'm skipping some nuances here. But so if it's very divided, then actually this 15% threshold becomes more relevant. But if you have the thing where, like, let's say after Iowa and New Hampshire, you have four or five candidates that seem to have a pulse still. Like, that situation's kind of bad. We're right in that phase where you have those four or five candidates who all have life left. Then you have, all of a sudden, this huge number of states vote. I mean, it's not just California. It's also Texas on March 3rd, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Virginia. These are big states. Tennessee's a pretty big state. Again, a state I think should have one of the first four primaries, right? And then a week later, Michigan, Ohio. A week after that, Arizona, Florida, Illinois, somewhere in there, Colorado is going to vote. It hasn't picked a date yet in March. So the problem is, like, it used to be California would play this, like, tiebreaker role, and it has had other years. In 2008, it voted in February. But California used to have this role at the end where, like, we can break a big tie at the end, whether with actual delegates, because we have a lot of delegates, or with kind of momentum and media narrative and whatever else, right? I don't know. If I were California, if I were you, California, this is me talking frankly to California, I might go back to June.
Fair enough. And when you say bad, this could be bad, you mean bad for Democrats who don't want chaos at the convention.
It's great for journalists who want chaos. I mean, I'm openly rooting for a brokered convention. I want my biases to be clear.
And you also know New York
bad if you want, you know, I think there is some, it's debatable. I think there is some evidence that's bad for parties when you have a prolonged, messy nomination process, you know, and usually parties avoid it.
All right. Well, of course, we've got plenty of time to sort through this between now and when delegates actually begin to be assigned. So hopefully this was a good primer on what's to come in terms of the primary calendar. And I think we're going to leave it there. Nate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Galen.
Jeffrey, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for indulging me in that game of reordering the primary calendar. Listeners, tell us who you agree with most. Tweet at us or send us an email. podcasts@538.com. Did you agree with Nate's order, Galen's order, or Jeffrey's order?
Can we have 538 readers vote on the first four states? Can we do that?
Yeah, we can.
Why don't you send a tweet out, Galen?
Okay.
And I will retweet it.
Okay.
Give us your list of the first four states.
That's
going to
be so much data.
Well, don't we have interns?
Not yet.
Paid interns?
We do.
Paid
we will have
we pay
paid
our
interns.
Interns.
We're wrapping up that process right now, but we don't quite yet. All right,
some
listeners.
Poor soul will compile these answers.
We have two questions for you. Which four states do you think should go first? And of the three options that you heard on this podcast, who do you think wins? We'll sort through that on Twitter or by email somehow. But I think that's a wrap for today. And before we go, let me again remind you that we have a live show in New York City on March 20th. It's going to be a lot of fun, so we encourage you all to come. If you've ever been frustrated by the fact that you don't get to hear the swearing on this podcast, or you realize that there are some very obviously funny things that we've cut out in order to make the podcast family friendly, all of those things will be on display at our live show. Tickets are selling pretty quickly, so we encourage you to head over to 538.com/live to pick up yours for our live show in New York City on March 20th. Anyway, my name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Remember to rate us and tell your friends about us, or better yet, bring your friends to the live show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.